good evening and welcome, friends, fans, and colleagues, to another great show of Voices of the Sacred Feminine here on Blog Talk. I'm your host, Karen Tate, and I'm happy to be with you for this holiday show. I hope you had a wonderful Christmas, Kwanzaa, Yule, Solstice, whatever you call it, however you celebrate it, and perhaps you're kind of just gearing up for the New Year's weekend ahead of us. But whatever you're doing, I hope you're enjoying yourself and you are creating your new traditions and just having as much joy as one possibly can in this day and age. And speaking of that, this day and age, you know, as gloomy as things might seem sometimes, I think we really have to keep our eyes open for glimmers of hope. And I think we have had a number of glimmers of hope just recently. One of them, a big one, quite frankly, is actually the topic of our show. It's with our beloved Maria Gimbutas being her work being vindicated, and we're going to get into that in more depth in just a few minutes with Carol Christ and Miriam Dexter. But think about it for a minute. Webster's Dictionary declared feminism the word of the year. A week or so ago, or a couple weeks ago, the time has sort of just it's become one blend. But the Senate race, Democrats, you know, won there in Alabama. Roy Moore, the person we were all afraid would be elected to the Senate, with his you know, regressive leanings and, you know, going out with young girls, all of those things that came out in the news about this about this fellow. Luckily, black women especially came to the polls and handed us a win. I think that speaks to, you know, progressive ideas being what more people want than those ideas that aren't progressive, those ideas that move us forward or what the majority of us want. I read somewhere that the December issue of Vogue, there was an article about menstruation, and it was a positive article, you know, talking about female empowerment rather than the usual things we hear, those sorts of ideas where, you know, we should just take a pill and make it all go away. You know, we have to, you know, grab these victories where we find them and, you know, and really hold on to them and realize that we are making progress. Just think of all the awareness that is being raised right now and all the people that are motivated to get up off their couch and actually participate and make the world a better place. And along with all those things I've just mentioned, as I said, our beloved Maria, her work has been vindicated, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Lord Colin Renfrew, he really had been an obstacle to Maria, and I guess you might call him her arch enemy. I've heard him referred to that way. He was not a supporter of her theories. Well, now, you know, he is rethinking all of that and said it publicly, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. So I'm going to welcome Carol Christ and Miriam Dexter to the show. And Carol Christ just recently wrote a great blog on feminism and religion titled Maria Gimbutas Triumphant, Renfrew Concedes. And she will be joined, as I have said already, by her colleague Miriam Robbins Dexter, who's been on the show here many times, both both of these ladies have been with me very often, you know, to my great pleasure. We always enjoy them here. And the two of them will reflect on the concession by this powerful archaeologist. And he's kind of been an academic gatekeeper and a vociferous critic of Maria Gimbutas. So that's what we're going to jump into and discuss right now. So, ladies, Carol, I know it's I think it's early in the morning for you, you know, over in Greece. Thank you for, you know, calling in at this, you know, not the best time, but this is an important subject. So thank you very much. And Miriam, I know you're a little bit under the weather, but I'm glad we're all here tonight. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen.
So, ladies, let me just start with your bios, because I know, you know, every show we have new listeners, and for those who don't know of your extensive scholarly backgrounds, you know, let me share that with listeners so that they know that what we are talking about tonight, you are probably some of the best experts on that, and, you know, we're going to be getting it right here, and then we'll jump right in. So I'll just start with Carol. Carol Crist holds a PhD from Yale in Religious Studies and is a founding voice in the study of women in religion and in the goddess movement. She's the author of 8 books, including most recently Goddess and God in the World, Conversations in Embodied Theology with Judith Plaskow, and the reissue of her memoir, A Serpentine Path, Mysteries of the Goddess, which describes her transformation on the first goddess pilgrimage to Crete. Her books are available on Amazon. There's also information on the goddess pilgrimage to Crete that she has been doing for years. You can find that on her website, goddessariadne.org. Carol says that Maria Gimbutas' insights about the peaceful, settled, egalitarian, matrifocal cultures of old Europe that worship goddess as the powers of birth, death, and regeneration have been confirmed for me in over 20 years of study of the art, artifacts, and archaeology of ancient Crete. The argument from absence is convincing. There are no larger-than-life-size depictions of a king, as in Egypt and Syria, and taken as a whole, the cultural artifacts do not celebrate warfare, violence, and or domination. Miriam holds a PhD in ancient Indo-European languages, archaeology, and comparative mythology from UCLA. Her first book, When's the Goddess, a source book in which she translated texts from 13 languages, was used for courses she taught at UCLA for a decade and a half. She completed and supplemented the final book of Maria Gimbutas, The Living Goddess. Her 2010 book, co-authored with Victor Mayer, titled Sacred Display, Divine and Magical Female Figures of Eurasia, won the 2012 Association for the Study of Women in Mythology Sarasvati Award for Best Nonfiction Book on Women and Mythology. In 2013, Miriam and Victor published a new monograph titled Sacred Display, New Findings in the University of Pennsylvania online series, Sino-Platonic Papers. And with Vicki Noble, Miriam edited the anthology for Mothers of the Women's Spirituality Movement, Elders and Visionaries. Miriam's the author of over 30 scholarly articles, 11 encyclopedia articles on ancient female figures. She's edited and co-edited 16 scholarly volumes. For 13 years, she taught courses in Latin, Greek, and Sanskrit language in the Department of Classics at USC. She's guest lectured at New Bulgarian University and Alexandru Ioan Cuza University in Romania. So, as I said, dear listeners, I couldn't have two better women with me tonight to discuss this incredible news about Maria's work being vindicated. So let's start at the beginning, and let's bear in mind, ladies, that some listeners don't know the history here and don't know all the details. So, Carol, I'll throw it to you first. Let's talk a little bit about your blog, you know, in Feminism and Religion, and the lecture where you know, this arch enemy of Maria actually finally decided she's been right all along.
Okay.
I think first I'll start with a little bit of a review of some of Maria's scholarly contributions. She was born in Lithuania, and she got her PhD in Germany, and then she came to the United States and studied at the Harvard Research Library and wrote several books while she was there. Then she was given a position of professor of archaeology at UCLA, and from there she taught for several decades and also conducted numerous archaeological digs in Greece and Eastern Europe. And this was the basis of much of her work. And she also had the ability to read almost all of the European languages. She said 20 languages. And so unlike most other scholars trained in America or in England, she was able to read not only works that were written in French and German, but also in Eastern European languages and in Russian. So she had a massive knowledge, which is often forgotten by her critics. Her most famous work is The Language of the Goddess, in which she reproduced images of thousands of small images, mainly small statues, but also artworks from the Neolithic period. These images have inspired women in a variety of fields, including artists and the women's spirituality movement, as well as scholars. In these images, she shows that the goddess was the primary deity in old Europe, and she was understood to be the life force in nature, the powers of birth, death, and regeneration that sustain all of life. Sometimes people think it's a fertility goddess or a mother goddess, but it's much more than that. Maria liked to speak of the goddess as the creatress of all and the power in enlivening all, not only human life, not only giving birth to babies, but all of the birth, death, and regeneration that occurs throughout the seasons and cycles of our Earth and the universe as a whole. And she, however, believed that her most important work was her next book, which is called The Civilization of the Goddess. And she said that she might have liked to have called it Europe Before Patriarchy or Europe Before the Indo-Europeans, but the publisher changed the title, as they often do. I've had it happen to me many times. And so the title doesn't describe the work as clearly as it might. I've just been reviewing The Civilization of the Goddess in preparation for this conversation. And in The Civilization of the Goddess, Maria reviews archaeological reports from hundreds of archaeological digs in the Neolithic period in southern and eastern Europe and Europe as a whole, including England and the northern European countries as well. And the importance, why she considered this her most important work, I believe, is because this is the material evidence. This is the physical evidence. This is the evidence on the ground. People can criticize her and say, oh, how do we know it's a goddess? It just looks like a fat old lady, or it just looks like a pregnant woman, or maybe it's a doll. And that's a facile dismissal of her work, and it's not accurate. But they say, how does she know that there was a peaceful society? How does she know that there was a goddess culture? And in The Civilization of the Goddess, Maria Gimbutas looks at the evidence on the ground in support of her theory, which I'll just mention again, which is that old Europe was a peaceful, matrifocal, settled agricultural society that worshipped the goddess as the powers of birth, death, and regeneration in all of life. And in contrast to that, she describes the Indo-European culture, which is the one that we've inherited through our university systems, through the ancient Greeks and so forth, as a patriarchal, patrilineal, horse-riding culture that worshipped the shining gods of the sky as a reflection of their bronze armor and weapons, a warlike culture that invaded Europe. Now, old Europe existed from about 6,500 to 3,500 before the Common Era, before Christ. And the Indo-Europeans began coming into Europe about 4,400 BC, but their major invasion was in the 3rd millennium, that is between 3,000 and 2,000 BC. And now we've come to the point of the lecture by Colin Renfrew and my blog. Colin Renfrew is an English academic. He was a decade or so younger than Meridian Buddhist, still living, and he's been understood to be the grand old man of British archaeology, and of course Americans tend to look up to Brits in a lot of cases, especially since he's now considered to be Lord Colin Renfrew. We all kind of bow down to that, even though we don't believe in it. And he has been a very, very powerful gatekeeper in the field of archaeology. I would say that he has been in charge of many journals and also book publications. He has the power to reject articles, to require them to be rewritten, to include his point of view and so on, and to exclude Maria's. And Colin Renfrew really has been a leader in the attack on Meridian Buddhists, despite the fact that they were close friends at one point and even excavated together over a several-year period. The point of their dispute had to do with how the Indo-European languages got introduced into Europe. But the real point behind it, I believe, is much more, is not so technical, and it's much more emotional. What happened when the language of the goddess was first published is that a lot of women were totally inspired by Maria's depiction of the culture of old Europe as being pre-patriarchal, peaceful, and matrifocal, that is, female-centered, not female-dominated, and worshiping the goddess. And a lot of them went to universities, and they said, oh, I want to study that. I want to study that. I want to study when women had power and there was no war, and the goddess was the central symbol. And I think it just freaked academics out. They just didn't, I suppose most of them were male at the time, and they just didn't know what to do with that. These women weren't all highly educated yet, and so they were able to dismiss them as just speaking fantasies. And Meridian Buddhist was basically dismissed with the same brush. Scholars began to write that her work was based in a dream of a golden age, a fantasy of a world without war, a fantasy that there was a time before patriarchal domination. And it's such a misunderstanding of the depth and breadth of her work. But articles that just kind of picture her as a person who sat down on her armchair and imagined a goddess keep getting republished. Well, Maria's work is not written. I think I'll turn it over to Miriam to talk a little bit about the Kurgan theory, and then we can return and talk about Colin Renfrew's speech.
Perfect.
Okay, sounds like a plan, ladies. So, Miriam, would you please?
Yes, I'm very happy. Maria's theory was that the Proto-Indo-Europeans had a homeland north of the Black and Caspian Seas in the forested and grassy steppe areas, which is why, of course, they early on domesticated the horse, because you really need a horse to traverse those distances. About 4,500, 4,400 BCE, for some reason, either there wasn't enough food, or there was drought, or there was overpopulation, but people moved out of the steppe areas and started migrating in all possible directions, north, south, east, west. I believe that they were mostly male, and there are some wonderful recent genetic articles that are showing that most of these movements were most of the movements by peoples who ended up all over Europe, Italy, Spain, Greece, the British Isles, Ireland, Germany, Scandinavia, as far east as all of the Danube cultures, in Romania, Bulgaria, Serbia, as far northeast actually as Chinese Turkestan, and south into India and Iran and other cultures as well. These are all the points to which these people migrated, and genetic studies are being done in these areas, finding that there is an incursion during the time which Maria marked as the three waves of migrations. There are incursions of a new genetic strain, R1, I believe R1A, which can now be traced back to the steppe areas, again, north of the Black and Caspian Seas. So the genetic evidence actually shows that mostly males came out of the Indo-European homeland, and that was the homeland, because that is the origin of this haplogroup, this genetic marker, and that they then spread in all directions. And often their genetic signature, especially in the early waves of migration, is relatively small. But we do see that there is an incursion of a new genetic haplogroup, and it belongs to these males. So that was Maria's Kurgan theory, Kurgan named for the kinds of mounds, Russian word, the kinds of mounds that were put over graves among the Kurgan peoples. As they moved out, you can see differences in graves, and Maria was able to trace, without doing genetics, a difference. The difference was that First, the Indo-Europeans went to the Danube area, Eastern Europe, and there, all of a sudden, there are not just collective graves with very, what I would say, equal grave goods. There are also now graves of males who had a lot of goods. So there is now some special status accorded to these newcomers for whatever reason. So you can trace the burials and see the migrations of the Indo-Europeans in that way. Now, when the Indo-Europeans migrated, they carried not just the Proto-Indo-European language, but also in different waves, different Indo-European groups had already come closely together, for example, the Balts and Slavs. So these languages were carried to all the different places they migrated. And for whatever reason, because they had superior status, superior force, the horse, it's at this point we don't know for certain, but their languages won out. And the languages that were spoken in all of these areas became substrate. They added to the sound system of the new languages, the phonology. They even added to the grammar. But all these languages became Indo-European. Colin Renfrew wrote a book a couple decades ago, more, whose hypothesis was that the Indo-Europeans were European farmers who then migrated in various directions. There is no farming, very little farming technology in Proto-Indo-European, so that makes that not work. And furthermore, now we know that indeed the Indo-Europeans had to have come from the steppe area, because that is the origin of this DNA haplogroup. I think that sort of covers it, unless you have any questions.
Yeah, I can pick up from there.
Okay.
Well, just one question, Miriam, before we go back to Carol. I just want to make sure I understand the significant difference between what Maria believed and what Renfrew believed. So are you saying that Maria believed it was more of an invasion where the other fellow, Colin Renfrew, I have trouble saying his last name, Colin Renfrew, believed it was just peaceful farmers? Was there more to it than that?
There's more to it than that. The migrations were different in intensity. The early migrations were some of the migrating people assimilated with the people who were already there, the indigenous people, while others left fires, left some evidence of mass burial. So there was both invasion and assimilation. So it isn't quite hard and fast. Also, there's a great time difference between Colin Renfrew's theory and Maria's. Colin Renfrew believed that the Indo-European languages spread throughout Europe and parts of Asia around 6,000 BCE, whereas Maria believed it was more like 4,400, and that all the sedentary farmers were pre-Indo-European. Does that answer your question?
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and just to put it in another way, I did my DNA a few years ago, and I found that there are two main DNAs that you can do, your mother's mDNA and your father's yDNA. The mDNA is passed to both males and females, but it's only passed on by females. So my mDNA came from my mother line, from my mother, my mother's mother, and so on back to people unknown. My father did his yDNA, and the yDNA is passed from father to son, not passed to the female. So I don't actually have my father's yDNA marker in my genetic history. But what I found was that my MDA, which happens to be from the T line, is dated to about 18,000 BC, its origins. And it dates back to migrations out of Africa and then migrations that continued into the Middle East and then up into Europe after the end of the last ice age. And my father, who did his a few years later, he had this R1Y DNA marker that Miriam talks about. And I hadn't been following the research as closely as Miriam had been at the time, and it was just starting to come out. But I looked it up, and this R1 marker is carried by more than half of all European men. More than half, far more than half.
Now,
whereas the markers for the female line tend to go back to the Paleolithic, to the old Ice Age period, time of the cave paintings in Lascaux and so on. And the male DNA goes to 2500 BC, approximately. That's what it's dated as, before, a little before, a little after. And that's what my dad carries. Now, then you ask the question, how did this happen? That there are all of these, there are many, 10 or so DNA lines dating way, way, way back in the mother line. And there's this one main line in the father line. And I looked up some articles. Of course, they were probably basing their work partly on Maria Gimbutas, but the idea, the most convincing idea, is that these people came in and took over. They were groups of men, as Maria said. Perhaps, I think maybe they were traders in the beginning, because men, even Maria said that men were primarily involved in trade. They came in, saw what was there, and started to take it and settle down with the things, the lands and properties that they'd taken over. And because they were, although they were a smaller group of people, their children were more likely to survive. They probably being, I believe they were warlike. Miriam sort of didn't say that, but that's what I believe. I mean, she didn't say it because it's questioned. They were warlike. They took over land. They took over property. They took over women. They killed the men, and they took over the women as their wives, slaves, and concubines. And so they were able to reproduce, and that's why the male DNA of the Indo-European invaders has taken over in Europe from the male DNA of the earlier peoples. But the females, apparently Miriam was right, they didn't bring that many females with them. They married, enslaved, or raped the women of the women who were already there in the land. So the female lines continued. Now this theory that I, as I presented it, and that's the way Maria presented it too, that it was an invasion, not simply an incursion or a movement of peoples, has been very unpopular in archaeology. Archaeologists of Colin Renfrew's generation had the theory that they called processional archaeology. That is, that cultures are not changed by invasion or takeover or hostile violence or things like that. Cultures simply evolve. So taking the processional view, we can imagine that maybe we could even concede that there could have been a more peaceful time, but it evolved into a warlike culture through internal reasons, not because somebody came in and conquered you, but because you just decided it'd be good to have weapons and male domination. And that's been the view. Now, I find that view incredibly self-serving, especially when perpetuated by an Englishman who ruled the world, whose country ruled the world through colonization in our historical memory. And we know very well that the Americas were taken over and their cultures were pretty much destroyed, their languages pretty much destroyed by a superior people, a superior people meaning superiorly armed, having better weapons, better ability to take over from an unarmed or less armed culture. And, I mean, we know that wasn't a process, unless we want to completely deny the facts on the ground. That was not a process where the Indians in America said, "Oh, gee, I think we'd rather be Europeans." No,
The words denial, wishful thinking, disillusionment, all of those things come to mind. I mean, one only has to,
not
as you
on
said,
the real side.
I mean, one has to do is look at the history of the world and how things happen. And processional,
no question.
Too. I mean, what a benign term, processional, as if they, I think of a procession in a church or something, just this benign walk in, and that's crazy talk, I think.
Maria did say that the successive waves became more violent. So by the third wave, there's a whole lot of violence, and that's very close to the Bronze Age, where so many cultures were destroyed, like Troy.
Yeah. So Carol, could you sort of summarize, was there any more to Renfrew's speech that you wanted to share your reaction to it?
Unfortunately, the University of Chicago Oriental Institute, which is where he gave the speech, which was the first inaugural Maria Gimbutas lecture. They had the speech online, and I used it. I listened to it a couple of times and used it in preparing my blog. It's now offline. I don't know I know
take
the blog
away
the
has evidence.
Been sent out on Facebook more than 1,000 times. Maybe it got to the eyes of Colin Renfrew and he said, I think I better rewrite that speech before it goes public. Who knows? Or maybe I don't even want anybody to be able to quote it. I don't know what happened, but it's been removed with no reason given from YouTube. In any case, in the lecture, Lord Renfrew, Colin, as I called him, talked about his friendship with Maria. And throughout the speech, he calls her Maria, not Maria Gimbutas, not Professor, just Maria. And so in my blog, I called him Colin just for fun.
I love that.
We usually refer to each other by first names, And we're doing it here, but we both knew Maria, and we're not giving an academic lecture. I wouldn't call her Maria. We were giving an academic lecture, not even in the blog. I called her the Buddhist. But he talks about, first he talked about his friendship with Maria, and then he talked about, he gave a, I would say, a archaeology 101 lecture. It wasn't very, nothing new in it, about the origin of the theories about the Indo-European languages, how they've changed over time. Maria's Kurgan theory, his theory that the Indo-European languages came from Anatolia or modern Turkey, and he also discussed his own processional view. And then at the very end of the lecture, he talked about the research on the third, what Maria called the third Kurgan wave, where this is roughly 2500 BC, before and after. He talked about the new research showing that this wave did actually exist. They did come from, it's scientifically been proven that these people did come from north of the Black Sea. They did come down into Europe, and they did somehow take over in terms of their Y DNA becoming the most prominent DNA in Europe. And so he conceded that she was right. In fact, he said, Maria Gimbutas's, he didn't say Gimbutas, he said Maria's Kurgan hypothesis has been magnificently vindicated. And basically, if you listen to the lecture closely, what he concedes is that there was a group of people who came down from north of the Black Sea and brought the Indo-European languages into Europe. He does not concede that there was a previous pre-patriarchal peaceful goddess-worshipping matrifocal sedentary agricultural culture that was in contrast to the culture brought by the Indo-Europeans, which was patriarchal, patrilineal, warlike, and so on. So he doesn't concede that. He only concedes that these people came down and that that part of her Kurgan hypothesis has been proved. But I concluded my blog by saying that even though he only conceded part of her theory, his concession would probably open the doors for other archaeologists to consider her work as a whole more seriously. And hopefully that will be the case.
So, ladies, why do you think he said anything at all? I mean, could he not ignore it anymore? I guess I just wonder, why did he even crack the door open?
Because of the new DNA evidence, it's irrefutable.
Okay.
Do you want to repeat that?
Yeah.
Do you want to repeat that just so the readers get it? Or the listeners get
yes.
it?
Yes. Sorry. He couldn't hide any longer from the truth because of the new DNA evidence that's come out in the last few years. It's irrefutable evidence.
So what will it take to prove the rest of her theories?
All people have to do is go to Eastern Europe to the museums and look at the artifacts. I mean, these were artifacts made by sedentary cultures which had enough free time to create absolute beauty. The flowing lines of the designs on some of the pots, they created not just female figurines, but just gorgeous pottery and other work.
So let me ask. Go ahead, Sarah.
Can I talk about Crete?
Yes, please.
And I would agree with Maria. I haven't been able to do. I mean, with Miriam, I haven't been able to do
Thank
that.
Thank you for that.
But I've been spending the last more than 20 years going four times a year or more to the archaeological museums in Crete, and Maria considered Crete to be the final flowering of the culture of old Europe, despite the fact that it had moved into the Bronze Age, past what the Neolithic stage of early agriculture. And the reason that Crete would be the final flowering of old Europe is because it was the southernmost point in Europe. If the so-called invasions or incursions were coming down from the north, Crete would be the last place they could hit. And since the Indo-Europeans were not primarily seafaring peoples, they didn't immediately duck down to the bottom of the Peloponnese in Greece and jump into their boats and go conquer Crete. Also, Crete was a very powerful trading partner throughout the Mediterranean area in that period, and they probably left them alone because they wanted the stuff that they were producing. But in Crete, one of the things that's, if you spend a lot of time with the art and artifacts of Crete, there's basically no depiction of violence. You can find one or two little pieces that might show a little tiny bit of violence out of thousands of artifacts. And they're also, the artifacts are, I mean, you don't see the lion killing the lamb, you don't see the hunter killing the prey, except for maybe on one piece, and you don't see soldiers fighting with each other, you don't see Perseus holding the head of Medea, the severed head of Medea, you don't see Amazons being defeated, you don't see rape, you don't see any of that. Basically, the artifacts are small scale. That is, most of them are less than 12 inches high. Many of them are the artifacts of images of animals and humans are pretty small, very small. No statues that you have to look up and go, "Oh my God, that must be God," or "Oh, I better bow down to this king." There's nothing like that. They're all on a small scale. They're all, as Miriam said, incredibly beautiful, spirals spiraling into spirals, life bursting forth from spirals in the form of flowers, seeds bursting forth into plants, and so on. It's a celebration of life, just exactly what Maria Gimbutta said, the powers of birth, death, and renewal in all of life, not even primarily in human life, but in all of life. And if you contrast that with a visit to the museum in Athens, the National Archaeological Museum, You will be shocked. Because there, almost around every corner, is Perseus holding the severed head of Medea, our soldiers fighting other soldiers. Athena herself has got a sword, and she's presiding over a battle between two generations of the gods. It's all about violence. And also the size.
Right.
Everything is bigger than you. So you go in and you go, "Oh, isn't that great?" And that's not what the ancient Cretans were trying to do. They were trying to say, "Isn't it wonderful that we're part of this?" And the size is so important. And I call it the argument from absence. There are no kings being worshipped. There's no image of a king. There's no big god. There's no big male figure. In ancient Crete, and this is the difference.
So two questions, parallel questions. You said that the talk has been removed. Is it possible, are there transcripts out there, or could transcripts be made? And the second question is, I mean, I've talked to you ladies and other people on the show about if scholars, wanted to stick by, Maria's theories, they couldn't expect to get tenure, that sort of thing. So they had to, toe the academic line, so to speak. Do you think this might change that? And I'll throw it out to whichever one of you ladies feel most comfortable answering those questions.
I think we have a long way to go before women will get tenure for focusing on the divine feminine.
Well, that's not a good answer, Miriam, but I appreciate your candor.
Well, I could say that.
Well, it's a start. Baby steps. Baby steps,
Baby steps, right.
Neither of us got the jobs that we might have liked to have gotten for our work. But just recently, the Heraklion Museum has been revamped and reopened, and it's following another wave of archaeological theory, which is to talk about the material culture, which, of course, Maria was doing herself, to talk about the artifacts from daily life. But one of the things that we haven't mentioned here, but I'll just say it now, is that the reason the Neolithic period was a period when women were honored and revered is because it's most likely that women invented agriculture. Why do we think that? Because agriculture must have developed not out of hunting, but out of those who were doing the gathering, those who were gathering the fruits, the nuts, and the berries, those who were preparing food at campsites or in the mouth of caves. And they would have noticed, the people who were doing this, who were collecting these things and preparing them to eat, would have noticed that if they dropped some seeds around the campsite, one year some little shoots came up, and guess what? It was the same thing as the seeds we dropped. This is why almost all people who consider this question, and I'm talking about scholars, would, as one of our friends used to say, concede that women probably invented agriculture. And then they move right on and don't discuss it. And in the new Heraklion Museum, they start off with the invention of agriculture. Man, I mean, they use the male generic in both Greek and English. Man has developed a new technology. It's called agriculture. And they don't even mention that it might have been women, or it probably was women, not man or men, who invented agriculture. And way back in the corner of the first room, they have a very small display of goddess, we call them goddess statues or statuettes or figurines. And they say, these images are female, male, and unknown, an animal, and we don't know what they mean. And, well, you know, if they were taking Maria's work seriously, they would say, because women invented agriculture, the symbol of the female body became a symbol of the creative powers of the universe. Da, da, da. And it wasn't just the power to give birth, it was the power to conserve the mysteries, to tell other people how agriculture works. And it was an intelligent power, not just a bodily power. It was both. Blessed be. But they don't do that.
So Miriam,
put, Carol. Yes.
Yes, yes, absolutely, Carol. Thank you. Well, Miriam, I want to ask you, I mean, it may feel like you're sort of stating the obvious, but just to try to help connect the dots, you know, for folks who haven't been following this for years, like you two, this dispute, this whole thing. Why should feminists be interested in it? And how does that connect to goddess and the divine feminine? I mean, can you sort of connect the dots between all of that, please, so that they have a clear picture?
Yes. It's the difference between equalitarian culture, where everyone can flower, and patriarchy, which absolutely suppresses women and people of any other ethnicity, and anybody who doesn't look like that person and have the gender of that male person. So it's a difference between flowering and suppression, in my opinion.
Okay.
And just to continue, it's also, Karen, you sent us a quote a couple of weeks ago when you asked us to be on the program, from Simone de Beauvoir, in which she said that women don't have a history, they don't have a culture. And therefore, even though they're probably the largest oppressed group in the world, they don't band together because there's nothing taught. They don't have a history, a culture, a religion that can tie them together. And I think part of the reason for the visceral emotional reaction against Maria Gimbutas's work is that she was offering women a history. And she wasn't just offering a history and a religion and a culture that was different from the patriarchal culture. She was saying, this is the culture that we need to turn to if we intend to survive on the face of Earth, because the other culture, the one that celebrates war and domination over women, nature, and other peoples, is about to destroy the possibility of life as we know it on Earth, not only
right.
for humans, but for other than human species as
Absolutely.
Well. And they,
well,
of course,
you know,
they didn't like that because that was, to them, her emotional reaction. Well, good for her. I mean, shouldn't we be emotionally reacting to the fact that we're living, at, as you said at the beginning, Karen, in very difficult times for for people and Mother Earth?
Well, and let's face it, you know, aren't men, and of course not all men, but the sorts of men that we're talking about, you know, aren't they being emotional when they are continue to be in denial about all of this? I mean, just the word patriarchy, I mean, it feels like you can't even say the word. I remember talking to Heidi Gottner-Abendroth about the pushback she would get just trying to talk about patriarchy at conferences. And I've been appalled, quite frankly, and look, I will be the first one to admit that I have sort of been resisting the news. I don't have, you know, I don't have the ability or the desire to read everything out there. But in this hashtag MeToo discussion that's been going on here in the United States and has bled over into Europe, I have yet to see an article that lays this male privilege and this, you know, this male privilege and license to abuse and do violence at the feet of patriarchal religion. You know, no one has connected the dots there. Keep waiting to find something.
It's patriarchal religion, but also patriarchal socialization. It's all the different forms of life in what I don't necessarily consider civilized culture.
Yeah,
true.
Go
ahead, Carol.
I had a conversation a couple of years ago with two friends who are Minoan archaeologists, a senior scholar and a junior scholar, and they like me. You know, they've known me for years. They respect me on some level. And they know that I bring very smart women over to Crete, and that surprises them. Anyway, they both believe that the Minoan mother goddess was the primary deity in ancient Crete. They tend to, would like to believe that it was a peaceful culture. They tend to believe that. But the senior scholar had recently uncovered an artifact, and he defined it as the king and the queen being received by the goddess. And so I said, if you look at it, they're not wearing crowns, you know, they're not that much bigger than anybody else in this little diorama. Why do you have to assume that there's a king and a queen or any type of a ruling elite in ancient Crete? That was the topic we met to discuss. As soon as, I don't know what my friend and I said, but as soon as we opened our mouths, the younger scholar said, but men aren't responsible for all the evil in the world. There were women guards in Nazi Germany. And I was just like, dumbfounded. I said, nobody said men are responsible for all the evil in the world. If something is, it might be called patriarchy, but
patriarchy is.
Men are not, all men are not patriarchal, and all men didn't create patriarchy. But we could not get off the subject of evil and Nazi Germany, and never were able to discuss in a rational way any of the evidence about Minoan Crete. So this is, they accuse us of being emotional.
Yeah.
But
the emotional
reaction just came right out.
Then they don't
want to look at the evidence that there might be a different way.
Well, you know, it feels like there are so many taboo subjects, you know. I know it's been difficult sometimes on social media. With the Roy Moore Senate race, when you saw how so many white women supported Roy Moore and how many the black women, who I'm certain feel more oppressed, well, you know, they sided with the Democrats. And I understand it, you know, having taken taken some courses of political activism, you know, its intersectionality. But, you know, I feel like that, you know, those sorts of things need to be talked about because it speaks to maybe, you know, I guess going back to that quote again from Simone de Beauvoir, you know, we need to look at why women can't, you know, come together in solidarity. You know, why do they side with the oppressor? You know, because you do have, you know, the women who've propped up the KKK, the women who support female genital mutilation, the women who support corporatism over, you know, people having a more level playing field and workers not being exploited. You know, all of that. They keep the churches, patriarchal churches, propped up. I mean, if women woke up one day and didn't support patriarchy anymore, the world would absolutely change. But it seems like it's a difficult subject to talk about, as is white female privilege. And I don't know, is either of you have any thoughts on that?
Well, yesterday I was watching on my Facebook feed, came up a lecture, an interview by Robert Rice, the economist from Berkeley, with Arlie Hochschild, who's a sociologist from UC Berkeley. And it was about her recent book in which she talked about the what did she call it, the story that white people who vote against their own interests to tell themselves. And it's a story about how, you know, they've been working hard all their lives and somebody butted into the line in front. She didn't use the word butted, but that's exactly what they would use, butted into the line in front of them. Whether it was a black, a woman, a gay, or whatever, a Muslim or whatever, and got ahead and is getting, you know, the place that they have worked so hard. Anyway, in the course of the lecture, they started discussing the fact that she found that many of the people she interviewed liked Bernie Sanders and they hated Hillary Clinton. Now, there's good reasons to hate Hillary Clinton, Karen, and I know a lot about that. But anyway, you know, they just passed that right over and they never said, they hated Hillary Clinton in part because she's a woman. And, you know, it's not just that they believe in whiteness. They also believe in white maleness. And, you know, the women, too, that vote along with their men. But, they again, it's like we just passed that right over.
It's frustrating. You know, because we can't actually get to the conversation. It just seems to keep getting pushed to the back burner. I mean, and likewise, you know, there's this a theology professor I hope to get on the show soon, Janine Hill Fletcher. She wrote a book claiming that white Christians are responsible for racism and discrimination in America. She herself is white. And, you know, she proposes that strategies that will foster racial healing, you know, might be first demanding that maybe white Christians accept their responsibility for racist policies, structural discrimination in America. I guess what I'm saying is, you know, there's so many people wearing so many different types of blinders. You know, the truth is so hard to come by, you know, maybe it's because we are into what we're into. You know, we have so long ago dropped those shackles that it's maybe a little bit easier for us to see the culprits, in a sense. And, you know, maybe that's not the best word to use, but to see where the oppression comes from, you know, and the people who prop it up. And I think it's really hard to upset some people's apple carts that, you know, it may be them.
Yeah, or their favorite professor or their favorite book or their father or...
Yeah. It's an uncomfortable subject, you know. It's controversial, it's awkward, but, you know, what do they say about, you know, you shed light on something and, you know, maybe you can heal it, cleanse it, whatever. And, you know, maybe we're going a little bit astray here, but it's peripheral to this conversation and the idea that, you know, women have no history, have no religion of their own. You know, I guess I just think about if more women were open to these ideas and could shake off the shackles of patriarchal thinking, patriarchal religion, and they would find so many more options open to themselves instead of being complicit in their own oppression.
Absolutely.
But, you know, I guess maybe that's asking a lot, maybe, you know. And maybe, again, you know, when you know, we're all in our own bubbles, and this sort of stuff is maybe easy for us to see and think about and talk about, where somebody else would, you know, only feels comfortable keeping their head buried in the sand at this point in their life.
Or feels more comfortable with traditional Abrahamic religion of one sort or another. And that keeps them really in a patriarchal vice.
Well, and maybe the truth of it is, I mean, myself coming from the South, I know most of the women, you know, that I knew back there, they don't care about feminism. They don't care that, you know, that males dominate their lives. You know, they would rather take a back seat instead of being in full partnership. I mean, the women I've interviewed from the Quiverful movement, for instance, you know, say that, you know, they know that they enter into, it's a deal, you know, they will submit to be taken care of. And that's kind of the deal they make going in. And maybe that's okay for some people.
Well, it's not really okay, but it's a deal that they're willing to make. I mean, at great cost to themselves, no doubt. I keep thinking about the fact that one of my friends was at a party at my parents' house, and one of my father's friends pinched her in the butt. This was 20 or 30 years ago. And she didn't say anything to me at the time, and I didn't say any, you know, so it never came out. But as I think about that, I think, well, what did they do to my mother? What did my father's friends do to all their friends?
Yes.
Why? Right. When they had a few too many drinks. I mean, women have been abused. And these women, you know, are the type of women who don't, if their daughter comes and says she's been, you know, sexually abused in the family, will brush it under the rug. If she herself has been sexually abused, they say, oh, well, you know, it only happened a couple of times. It wasn't that bad, and I've forgotten about it, so it doesn't matter. In order to keep this bargain going, you have to keep denying things that are right.
Denial, that's right.
And that have happened to your own body or the body of your daughters.
Before I go, are there any other questions about prehistory, or are at this point will you, Karen, and Carol talk about more contemporary problems?
Well, let me answer that by saying this. You know, this is a huge subject, and are there things I have maybe failed to ask, Miriam, that you think are important points that you want to make? Because if it is, please do. You know, because I don't want you to, you know, hold back from you know, mentioning some things about this that, you know, just because I haven't asked.
I can't think of anything offhand. I've really talked about what I hope to talk about.
Okay. Well,
yeah,
well,
I feel the same way. I feel
tonight.
That, you know, we can, this conversation has come to a very rounded conclusion. I think we've covered, you know, everything, and maybe we'll come on again sometime to talk about, you know, patriarchy in general or something. I feel quite pleased with the whole discussion.
Okay. All right. Well, great. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I've enjoyed the conversation, and I thank you both for interrupting your holidays to talk about this. And, you know, I feel like this was a gift to all of our listeners, you know, a gift for the holidays, not just that, you know, that Maria's work has finally been vindicated, but that you both came on the show and shared this important information, explained it all so we could all sort of get up to speed. And know what's going on. So thank you both so very much, and I hope you both have a great rest of your holiday.
And I
thank
think
you so
really,
much for having us on. And I
yeah,
just want
exactly.
to mention that dawn has broken while we've been talking. Dawn has broken here at Lesbos. So that may be it. We can take that as a sign.
Beautiful.
Well, I have that beautiful image in my mind, Carol. Thank you. Thank you so much. And Miriam, thank you so much, too. Thank you both
thank
for being
you.
On the show.
Thank you, Karen.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Good
night and Happy New Year.
Good morning.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah. All right. Bye-bye. Well, listeners, I hope you've enjoyed that very in-depth conversation that I just had with Miriam and Carol Crist. And if any of you were more interested in that quote we were referring to earlier by Simone de Beauvoir, let me read the whole quote to you. I'm probably going to be talking a little bit more about this with Leia LaFleur in the coming weeks, but Simone said, and I'll quote, women lack concrete means for organizing themselves into a unit which can stand face-to-face with the correlative unit. They have no past, no history, no religion of their own, and they have no such solidarity of work and interest as that of the proletariat. They live dispersed among the males, attached through residence, housework, economic condition, and social standing to certain men fathers or husbands more firmly than they are to other women. If they belong to the bourgeoisie, they feel solidarity with men of that class, not with proletarian women. If they are white, their allegiance is to white men, not to Negro women. That bond that unites her to her oppressors is not comparable to any other. I think that's really important. At least it's really meaningful to me because I, for one, was trying desperately a few years ago to understand what's so hard. You know, why won't women stick together? You know, we are the majority here in the United States. If we just stuck together, just imagine the things we might accomplish. And then, you know, since Trump got elected and you see stuff like white women supporting people like Roy Moore, you know, it begs the question, why does this happen? You know, why do are women so complicit in their own oppression? And this explains it. And, you know, more to the point, I think, of what we talked about tonight, Maria's work, this idea of a goddess-centered culture, you know, or an egalitarian or an equalitarian culture, you know, it goes back to the idea that we talk about sometimes about mythology shapes our culture. So, and it ties in here with what Simone de Beauvoir said, you know, mythology shapes our culture. She's just using other words. If women don't have their own religion, in a sense, the religion of that isn't patriarchal, if they don't have their own mother goddess, you know, if you have a culture that all the mythology is about a male god, well, you end up with male leadership. You end up with patriarchy, you end up with authoritarian systems like we have now, a dominator culture, as Rhianna Eisler talks about, and those are the values that are sort of shape society instead of collaboration, partnership, equality, peace, justice. You know, it's survival of the fittest. It's about the I and the me, not the we and the us. It's not about the common good. It's the guy with the most bombs and bullets. It's the guy with the biggest stick. It's about the strong man. And you know, so that's why it's so important that we have our own mythology, we have our own narratives, we have our own history. Otherwise, we just continue to get sucked into, and, you know, I'll use the word brainwashing, I'll use the word propagandized. You know, we end up with, you know, so many women that just buy into the culture of their oppressors, rather than understanding there is an alternative. So, yeah, it's a big subject. You know, it's about racism and sexism. It's about, you know, I like to think it's even You know, part of the problem of why we can't talk about anything besides capitalism as what we have, you know, for our economic systems. You know, you look at, you know, Calvinism and prosperity gospels, you know, and again, it's you know, has led to all this greed. I think it's Kevin Cruz has the book out that talked about how Christianity has been co-opted by corporations. And we wonder, you know, why we're in the shape we're in. There's really a lot to talk about. There's a big subject. But, you know, it really does go back to losing a feminine face of God, and you can connect the dots to all of these or an awful lot of these woes in society, whether it be, you know, women complicit in their own oppression, like the women who vote for Roy Moore, you know, a pedophile, basically, you know, or women who support female genital mutilation, or the KKK and white supremacy, and, you know, who vote for political parties that just, you know, further intensify the income disparity rather than supporting workers. You know, it I see it as all connected. You know, it is, you can just connect the dots from all of this. Losing a feminine face of God, we lose the feminine values, and we end up where we're at right now. But to bring things full circle, I do believe that things are potentially getting better. And I think these glimmers that I spoke about when I opened the show are relevant glimmers. We had that win in Alabama. We have how many more people, you know, how many more women running for office? How many more progressives running for office? I mean, it was unheard of before Bernie Sanders to be talking about income disparity and the domination of corporations. And, you know, the Democrats weren't really talking about any of this because they all went corporatist. You know, so Bernie Sanders has made, you know, huge headway to change people's thinking to more of a we and us mindset instead of an I and a me. I think people are maybe starting to understand more about what feminism really is rather than, you know, some of the more negative connotations of feminism. Again, the December issue of Vogue talked about menstruation, you know, in a positive way. So let's just hang in there, you know. Let's just keep doing what we do and standing for what we stand for and believing what we believe and putting out that energy into the world that reflects what we want to manifest. And, you know, I think we will prevail. I mean, how many of us thought in our lifetime our beloved Maria would be vindicated? Now, it's not a whole vindication yet, but it's a start. So, you know, feel good about these wins. You know, we have to feel good about them. We deserve to feel good about them. You know, consider these your presents under the tree. Well, that about does it for me tonight. I want to thank you all for tuning in. I hope you will share this interview with your friends so that everyone learns about this new news about Maria's work. And it is truly a wonderful thing. And all of our goddess-oriented, feminist-oriented, you know, folks, women and men alike, make sure they hear about this. Feel free to share this link wherever you like because the information is important, and we need to be the Pied Pipers, if you will. Well, I wish you all a very happy holiday season, and I will be back with you again next year. And I will let you hear the whole chant from the Reclaiming folks, Weave and Spin. It's one of their great activist songs. And I've been playing a lot of those lately. They're upbeat, and, you know, they're about solidarity and working together. So, again, this is from Reclaiming Campfire chants and songs. So we'll just close the show off tonight with Weave and Spin. Good night, dear listeners. Thank you so much for your listener loyalty, and have a great holiday. Good night. Thank you.